I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
All right, now it's Noco Moto episode 26. I'm your host, MotoG Pete, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yo.
All right. Now, I want to do a listener update here, okay? We begin a whole bunch of new listeners. I want to, like, highlight some new cities. So we are pretty big in Florida now, apparently. I don't know why Florida, Maine, Ohio, California. These seem to be the biggest states for whatever reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was, what, Niceville, Florida. We've got Miami. We've got, who else in Florida? Gainesville, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was another city in Florida. Do you remember seeing that in the listens?
There was another one.
It's weird because there's so many cities with the same number of listeners. So you just have to kind of wait until, like, they're the more recent than versus another city to actually see it pop up, because we only get to see, like, the top 10 at any given moment or whatever. But yeah, and then there's a whole, I feel like there's a fair bit in Connecticut and Maine as well. What was it? Kingsfield, Maine. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we've got Cincinnati and Columbus, and there's somewhere else in Ohio, Pataskala, right? Yeah.
I'm going to guess Pataskala.
Pataskala. Yeah. Well, okay. It's probably Pataskala, but I guarantee you there are locals that say Pataskala. I guarantee you. It's like, you know, Versailles, Indiana, right?
Right.
There's totally some Pataskala, Ohio people, right? There's got to be. Hey, if I'm correct on this, send me an email telling me if I'm right or wrong, please. But I would bet everything. There's a lot of Pataskala people out there. Okay. And then a lot of stuff popping up in Texas. We've picked up some people in Austin. That's new. There's always been a bunch of listeners from a bunch of small towns all over the state. But Austin's only just come in for us recently. And, of course, like, California's just all over the place, up and down the whole state. And I think recently we got a couple of people from Oregon. It's not a big listener area. I think literally I just saw two people from Oregon, which may have been listening for a while, but it was the first time I saw it pop up in the numbers. Cause if there's not a lot of people listening near you, it basically coincidentally, if I just check our listens, like right after you've listened, it'll pop up and then gone. And we've got maybe only like four or five very enthusiastic listeners in Australia. Most notably Paul, who sent me a really, really nice email, with a picture of, his son playing the MotoGP game right after they sat down and watched the German MotoGP round together. So he's bringing the boy up right.
He's wearing his motorcycle helmet while playing.
Yeah, big points from us. Let's see here. And then, also on listener updates, we got a bad review. Holy crap. I'm so excited about this.
Now, well, here's the thing. We've made it big enough to start getting bad reviews.
I know. I've been waiting for this day for like 7 months. Now, I'm actually a little disappointed that it really wasn't a total shit talking review, actually. The only way I feel bad about this is it wasn't a straight, like, one star, I hate you kind of review. Because, listeners, I used to play in a honky-tonk band playing steel guitar for a long time. I've been a hotel and restaurant manager for well over a decade now. There is no way you can hurt me with reviews, all right? Trust me, I have the thickest skin ever for this. But actually, this bad review was really wonderful. It is the best bad review you could ever hope to get. So this guy, I can't remember, he was like on two wheels, he identified himself as or something. And he said that he listened through 12 of our episodes before giving us the thumbs down. He also seems to think that we are knowledgeable and well-researched, which is a shocker, but okay, whatever. Cool. He admits that, you know, we know something about what we're talking about, so that's cool.
Evidently has a higher opinion of us than we do of ourselves.
Right. And he says that 40% of our commentary is worth listening to, so yeah, he only hates us 60%.
Wait a minute, is this the YouTuber?
YouTuber? What YouTuber?
On Two Wheels.
Oh, shit, yeah. Or is it Chase on Two Wheels?
Chase on Two Wheels, yeah.
I wonder if it's Chase on Two Wheels. That would be amazing. But it would probably be Chase on Two Wheels as the thing. I don't know. Anyway.
If we got a 2-star review from Chase on Two Wheels, that's a badge of honor.
Chase, if you're listening, I guarantee you, whoever it is listening again. This kind of person, like, listens again to see if, like, we mentioned that they did it, right? If you're listening, like, we love you. Because, honestly, it says a lot that, you know, we at least kept you for our first 12 episodes, right? The show's gotten better since then, right? And, I don't know, he seemed to have this idea, he said that we only talk to each other just to confirm that our opinion is superior to others, which is a really wonderful comment. And I don't want to say anything about him. He's completely entitled to his opinion, and it doesn't hurt my feelings at all. So I'm kind of looking at this objectively. I like that he, rather than just go 1-star and dip out, that he wrote some stuff. Like, we at least got him to feel something, right? You know, because kind of what you want is half of everyone to love you and half of everyone to hate you. Or you need to have some haters, because then you know you're not making bland content. You're not making bland material. You're getting emotion out of people, right? So it was a really nice affirmation to have this 2-star review, because, you know, but this, I am going to have a call to action here, in that, well, the only person that's actually bothered to write out a review is this 2-star review. And I think the 2-star review is a great asset to the show, believe it or not. But we do need other people to put in some positive ones that are actually written out to balance it, right? I think it's great for people to go through our reviews and see a mix of things. I think that says great things, you know, because if it's just a whole bunch of people licking our buttholes through the reviews, that's I don't know. That doesn't say a whole lot. But if there's, you know, one bad review and then 10 good ones, well, then I think the bad review actually helps. So if you really love this show, please take the time, just 10 seconds, and write out something like, hey, show's great, and that's it. Or you can write something longer if you want. I don't care. But it would be nice just to have a few good ones written out to be a contrast to that. And then that way, I think the 2-star review actually makes us look better, because he still had some weirdly positive things to say about us. And it's like the best, like, bad review you can get. Now, there's like 7 other people that have given us like 5 stars, but they haven't actually written anything out. And I think when it comes to your rating and everything, I think reviews that have a written review attached to them rather than just a rating count for a lot more on iTunes. I don't know exactly how it works. Apparently no one knows how it works. But everyone agrees it's important. So in any case, just putting that out there, you know, on Two Wheels, thank you. Or if anyone knows on Two Wheels, no, honestly, thank you for the bad review. It was pretty cool. It was fun to read it. All right. So then moving on, we've got, you know what? Let's talk bikes, right? We've gotten 10 minutes into this without talking any bikes. So we've got another update on the podcast bike, the Norge. So you got the bracket welded.
Yep.
And it's working just fine, except what?
This train never stops. Okay. So we got the bike welded. Dad rode it back down here and had many positive things to say about it. Yeah, including after having ridden it within a 15 minutes window, having 2 unsolicited mentions of the Moto Guzzi California.
Right.
Specifically in the context of if the Moto Guzzi California rides anything like the Norge.
Which it must, because I believe the California engine is based off of the 1200 engine that's in the Norge, because it's the same 4-valve overhead design that's in the Norge. Or is yours 2-valve?
Mine's 4-valve.
There we go. Yeah.
But it's a 1400 cc motor. It's a bit bigger. I think it might be the same motor in the Stelvio.
Right. But the bore and stroke's a little bit different. The compression's a little different. But the motor overall, it's the same motor design in general, I believe. Right. So the California is probably engineered to do a little less overall horsepower and a little more torque. But I thought I remembered seeing that the California has 100 horsepower, though.
It's got more horsepower. And more torque, but I think it leans, the ratio-wise, it leans more towards torque.
Right.
But in any case, let's get back to the Norge.
With the extra weight, it's gonna have similar engine, you know, throttle response.
Right.
It's, yeah.
Right. So, I get the bike back, and he's like, you know, you've really got the brake, it's got a really weird position. Like, what are you talking about? It's perfectly level with the clutch. That's where it's supposed to be. And then I get on the bike, and then I pull away, pull up to a red light on a hill, and you know, I look behind me, nobody's there, pop it into neutral, put my foot pressed down on the rear brake, let go of the handlebars to futz with my helmet, and oh, bike's rolling forward, what the fuck? You really do have to push a long way down, and the brake is not actuating until my foot is, like, fully extended.
Okay.
And, like, when I really push it as far as my foot can actually physically go flexibility-wise, like, the rear brake starts to engage. It's like, well, that's not right. That's not right at all. So I still pretty much don't have a rear brake. I get home. I was like, well, what's going on here? Okay, well, let's undo the bolt, take the lever off the bracket, pull it out, and the little nut that secures the adjuster is completely unwound, and it's just been screwing itself in. I don't know if it got messed up when Dad was putting it back together, or while he was riding down, if it just vibrated and it's just been slowly pushing itself in the whole time. So I push it all, I unwind it all the way back out, get it back to where it's supposed to be, lock the nut in place so that it's secure, put it back on, everything's great, and I go to put the return spring back on the lever that holds it back fully closed.
Right.
And the spring won't do the job. And I pull the spring off, it's like, well, am I attaching it to the wrong point? It just holds on to this bolt, right? Like, there's nothing else anywhere else it could go. Pull the spring off and just look at it, and you can see the gaps through all, through each loop, and the spring is just completely knackered. It's like, okay, I'm 0-for-2 in terms of satisfaction on parts shopping for the Norge. Went back. It was Sunday evening. I was desperate. I just went to Ace Hardware and thought, fuck it, can I find a spring that will do the job?
Yeah.
Found the closest fitting one. No good. Didn't work. So then I went and decided, okay, well, now I've got to go order online and shop for a part for the Norge. I did actually find the OEM part this time. There was no major dealer I could go through. There is no local dealer who I could browse parts for. There was nowhere directly through Piaggio I could order the part without a big warning showing up saying, if the part is not in stock, please wait 10 to 14 days for it to be resupplied, and for less requested parts, 45 to 60 days for parts that are only stocked in Italy.
Oh my god.
And it was like, well, it turns out this particular part is a spring that is on every standard brake lever on pretty much every single Piaggio motorcycle. But the only person who would offer me like two business day shippings was like this one guy somewhere out in Missouri, who owned his own parts supply for Moto Guzzi bikes. And I ordered from him, and got a confirmation email with first name at company instead of a no reply, no tracking number, anything. And this is what I have to resort to get parts for this bike. And I understand that Moto Guzzi is not Honda, it's not Yamaha, it's not Harley Davidson. But I feel like it's not that difficult to maintain like three warehouses when you're pulling like five brands together and you're consolidating a lot of stock. I realize, you know, all of your brands may make up 1% of the US market. But I feel like the parts supply and the parts support could be a lot better. And after owning three Japanese bikes, one closing in on 40 years old, and having no problem getting overnight and two-day shipping on obscure parts.
Yeah.
Like, you are way below par, Piaggio. And, you know, it may be, you know, it was, the spring was $1.50. And
yeah,
that $1.50 spring is now costing me like 6 days of riding because your parts support is not up to snuff. And
yeah,
it aggravates me and it makes me less excited about your brand and it makes me disappointed. And I'm going to keep harping on it every time it happens.
Yeah, that's completely fair. That's absolutely completely fair. There's no reason it should be that bad. Now, the question is if it's a brand new, like, Vespa scooter, do you have this problem? I don't know. I would guess that the part support on a GTS 300 is a lot better. But who knows, right?
Right.
So, I don't know. Maybe if we can get an email from someone that has a Vespa or something Piaggio, you know, that would be pretty sweet. Just to know if everyone else has the same problem, which I guess they probably do.
Yeah, I'm just super bummed that a quarter ounce of steel is stopping me from putting miles on this bike. Like, it shouldn't happen.
All right, let's see here. Should we do best worst bike right now?
It's time.
Okay, so disclaimer as always, because we've got still just a whole bunch of new listeners coming in. This is the segment where we take two bikes, we each choose one, we don't know what the other is chosen, and don't get upset if we choose one of your bikes as the worst bike in the world, all right? There'll be a new worst bike next week. It's only the worst bike in the world for 1 week, right? And, you know, I feel like I've got to start explaining it this way on the show, is that, you know, we frame it in the context as the best and worst bike in the world. We don't literally mean that. It's just a fun way to look at a couple, what might otherwise be pedestrian motorcycles, a different way. All right. So with that said, Swiggy, you've got the worst bike in the world this week, right?
I do.
You ready to reveal it?
Yep. Let's go.
And the worst bike in the world this week is
the Honda Shadow Arrow.
Okay, this is, yeah, a lot of people dislike this, but I don't know, there might be good things about it. We're talking about the 750 Arrow?
We are.
Okay.
Now here's the thing, this is a really popular bike.
Yep.
There, if you just pull up Craigslist right now, you will find no less than 12 Honda Shadow Arrows for under $3,300.
Yep.
And all with less than 15,000 miles in pristine condition.
Yep.
People really take care of these bikes, and a lot of people buy them. But do people love them?
Yeah. There's that great, not great, there's that sort of well-known David Allan Coe song, "It'll Be a Harley Someday." Like, that was written about this bike, right?
Okay, now, if I were to ask you when the Honda Shadow went fuel injected, what year would you say?
Oh, I would have said like 2008, maybe 2004, somewhere in that range.
2013.
Really?
Okay, here's a question for you. When do you think the Honda Shadow went 4 valves per cylinder?
I think this is a trick question. I think it's still 2.
So it has never gone 4 valve.
I am so good. Okay.
But it's a 3 valve.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. How cool.
Okay. 2 intake, 1 exhaust.
If you're making a low compression motor, there is a very, very good reason to go 3 valve instead of 4. That's way too complicated to get into right now. So I'm not going to hold that against it.
Okay. So here's the thing, though. It still doesn't have a digital display either.
That's a crime.
And when you're looking at what this bike does, which is really emulating a Sportster 883.
Yes.
When you consider the $7,500 price tag, but when you also consider fully loaded with the bells and whistles, with all of the Honda options, with the full chrome, bringing it close to $13,000.
Really?
If you spend $150 on the luggage racks and another $400 on the leather saddlebags and like $3,500 on chrome and another $550 on the sound system and another $500 on the windscreen.
So the fully optioned off the website 2018 Honda Shadow Aero with everything.
It's 12 to 13,500. It's a lot of money, and the $7,500 is without ABS.
Right. Which, you know, I wouldn't expect them to throw ABS on standard on this bike. It's not that kind of bike.
It's true. But when you look at how many of these there are out there, and you look at what it is, I would say more than 50% of the people riding this bike are using it as a stepping stone to another bike.
Yes, I agree.
Which people are not doing with the Bolt.
Right.
And they're not doing with the SCR 900. And they're not doing with, say, what's the other one? Actually, no. People are using the Boulevard, the C50 Boulevard. That is definitely a stepping stone,
right?
But this is so when you talk to somebody who owns a Sportster 883 and they're like, "Yeah, I know, it's my first bike. I'm getting rid of it. I'm upgrading to a real bike soon."
But at least it's a Harley, right?
This is like the notch below that bike. Not because it's inferior to a Sportster 883, but its perception among the people who buy it, who can't afford a Sportster 883, have that perception of it.
Yeah.
And when you really look at this bike in the long run, this bike hasn't, It hasn't changed. And in 2013, when it went fuel injected, I believe that was because Honda realized there wasn't a lawnmower that used similar carburetors.
Right.
And they couldn't make it that much older tech because nothing else wanted that part.
Right.
And so they were forced, kicking and screaming, to upgrade it to fuel injection.
Whereas if you look at like what Kawasaki has done, right, with the Vulcan 650S, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is in that same range, right? And they took a motor and they said, okay, all right, we're going to put this, rather than just, you know, keep recycling an old V-twin or, you know, use the 800 or 900 version out of the other Vulcan. They thought, let's take the 650 Ninja motor, you know, retune it a little bit and get a cruiser application. But let's also do a bunch of new stuff with the design, upgrade a lot of the little parts along the way. So for somewhere in between the base price and that crazy $13,000. I want to say a Vulcan S comes in somewhere around $9,000, which is really cheap or really expensive, whichever way you're looking at it. But it's a very comfortable, much better handling and cooler looking than the Shadow, right?
So the only reason I can think that this three-valve motor still exists when even Harley-Davidson has gone four-valve is that somewhere in South America or in Southeast Asia, somebody is using the 750 motor out of this bike.
Oh, in a car.
Like, no, in like the Lamborghini of tuk-tuks.
Right.
There's some weird application that this engine is being used for that doesn't relate to this bike at all, and it's in some other side market, and Honda's selling that on. Because I can't think of another reason why this particular motor is still being sold. And it's also close to 10 to 1 compression, and
that's still fairly low compression these days.
It is, but it's also a cruiser with a slightly under square motor as well. It's like 79 by 76.
Wait, this has a wider bore than it does a stroke?
Yes.
There's no way this is a short stroke motor. There's no way.
Well, it's 79 millimeters by 76, so it's basically square.
Which one's the bore?
It's bore then stroke. 79 millimeters by 76.
So 76 is the stroke.
Mm-hmm.
That's really surprising to me. Well, you know what? It has to be at only 750 to generate up to that 60-something horsepower. Yeah, in the V-tune configuration. No, that makes sense. That is a long stroke for a V-twin of that displacement, but that's not a long stroke in general. Right. So, yeah. You know, it is going to feel good to, like, rev it up as compared to a lot of other, you know, cruisers, whatever. You get to really pull that throttle and wring it out, which is nice. But, yeah, the riding experience on these, I've never ridden one. It might be fine. It might be totally, totally adequate, and this may be a really great starter option for people because you can find them cheap. What you're saying, and tell me if I'm off base here, is that for the fully decked out one, like, you're just throwing money away because, like you said, do people it's like getting really a fully love it?
It's like getting a fully optioned Civic.
Why?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's the other thing. A couple other things. Rear brake is still a drum.
Oh, yeah. Still, though?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
In 2018, it is still a rear drum, and it is still single overhead cam on a cruiser.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I have chosen this bike in particular, and this will validate all the people who like to shit on the CBR600RR, is... And it's an aspect of Honda that I also will criticize, which is, you know, Honda is this gigantic company at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And they kind of go through these phases with individual product lines where, you know, for something like the Goldwing.
Right.
Flagship product, spared no expense. Full Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Go nuts. It'll cost $30,000. We don't care.
But then they go, now we don't have to touch it for a decade.
Right. So all of these different products go through these evolutions where it's, this is really competitive. We want to get to the front of this market. We'll put tons of money into it. We'll put ridiculous amounts of R&D, and it'll be the very best. They'll dominate the market. Everyone just says, oh, just get the Honda. And then everyone just gets the Honda. And then they don't update it. And it's the same model next year, and it's still the best. And this is the exact same model next year, and it's still the best. And then there's another competitor, but they don't change anything. And then it slowly lags behind. And Honda just says, well, it's still selling, and we've still got bank reputation on this model. So we'll keep doing it. and we'll keep doing it, and we're going to wait until it stops making money, and then we'll overhaul the whole thing.
Right.
And the Shadow has done that in this very niche way where it just undercuts basically the entire Harley Davidson lineup, where somebody says, well, I don't really want to get credit for a brand new Sportster, and I don't want to buy an older one. I'd like a warranty. So they say, well, I can get a Shadow. It looks pretty close. I don't, you know, it's my first bike. I'd really like to get a Harley Davidson soon, but I'll pick this up and I can customize it. You know, it's a Japanese bike. It's reliable. And I think there's this very cynical mindset at Honda where they just say, well, it keeps working. Why would we retool this factory? Why don't we just keep pumping out this exact same motor? Well, we don't have any new old stock carburetors we can put in anymore, so I guess we'll go fuel injection, but let's keep pumping it out. Well, the Southeast Asian market doesn't give a shit about drum brakes. We still got these that we're supplying to a bunch of Taiwanese manufacturers. Well, let's just slap this on the rear brake. It's fine. And they just kind of kept going and kept going. And at this point, it's just, really? Still? There must not be a single person left at Honda besides a small handful of accountants who are really, truly enthusiastic about this motorcycle.
Yeah.
And for that reason, it is the worst bike in the world.
I agree. When the Bolt is kicking your ass in innovation, you need to take a long look in the mirror. All right, now it's time for best bike in the world this week, and I am really excited about this one. Okay, normally I've been doing a little bit of a story or somewhat introduction. I'm just going to lay this on you and then pile on facts to just blow your mind. The best bike in the world this week is the Ducati Supermono. Now, I've been on a Ducati kick.
Wait, the Ducati, the Supermoto?
Supermono.
Oh.
Now, let me lay some stuff on you here. This is a motorcycle which produces 76 peak horsepower. Let's see here. Oh, damn, where'd my spec sheet go? All right, here we go. This bike has a 100 by 70 bore and stroke. This bike has fuel injection. And
wait,
it's
100
from,
by 70?
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a single.
So a 700 single. Or not a 700.
No. Anyway, it's actually 549 cc's.
Okay, yeah.
It's a Desmo, dual overhead cam, four valve, liquid cooled, 11.8 compression, electric ignition, Weber fuel injected. It's from 1993. 42 millimeter inverted forks. Dual disc, four piston caliper brakes in the front with a single 190 mil disc, two piston in the rear.
What year is this?
93.
Ooh.
This has a wet, I repeat, wet weight of 301 pounds.
What?
This is a 4 gallon tank. And this runs 11.4 seconds in a quarter mile. So says motorcyclespecs.co.za. This motorcycle is insane. They did not make very many because this is a prototype racer that the public could buy for homologation reasons that was developed for the FIM Super Mono Cup, which is a prototype racing league outside of MotoGP, which exists in Europe. This motorcycle is $30,000 and it is just all carbon fiber. It is the absolute top of technology in the 90s. This thing is, yes, this thing is the most Ducati thing ever created. This thing, this is a single cylinder which revs to 10,000 RPM. Now, here's one of the coolest things about this motorcycle. You'd be like, how the hell do you get a 550 single to rev to 10,000 RPM? Because while it only has one piston firing and making power, it has a dummy cylinder as the counterbalance.
Oh.
Yeah. Completely getting around the traditional single cylinder architecture for an engine. It's absolutely bonkers. There is so much carbon fiber all over this thing.
So the counterweight is just a whole dummy cylinder that's just the extra weight going around.
Right, just with no valves or anything on top of it. Yeah, yeah. It's completely bonkers. This thing crushed it between 93 and 97 while they were making it in the Super Mono series. It just absolutely crushed. Nothing came anywhere near close. There are so many accounts of just completely jaded tastemaker, super elitist moto journalists from the time just could not stop singing the praises of this, even though it wasn't like, you know, 100+ horsepower, 1 liter crazy racing thing, because this is supposed to be just one of the most awesome handling, super fun, crazy awesome motorcycles to experience ever. Now, it's as rare as hen's teeth. And if you want to find one now, you're probably talking like $50,000 or something. But this looks more 90s than the 90s. This looks more Ducati than Ducati. Like the 350 Desmo, this is another one. You look at this and your boner power goes to 11. It's sort of like the 916 from the time, right?
I'm getting a lot of 999 vibes off this bike.
There's a little of that too. It's very 90s Ducati, but
I love how all up front, it's like the solid unbroken frame with like tiny little vents for the radiator.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you get right to the, Once you get to the cradle, it's like fully exposed trellis frame and then solid tank and subframe.
Right. This has a tank that Jorge Lorenzo would never be able to deal with. But even the seat on the back is beautiful. Like, just everything about this is just absolutely, you know, just it's for nothing but ridiculous prototype racing.
Where does the name Desmo Quattro come from?
It's four valve.
Oh, because it's four valve.
Right. They did a 570cc version as well, because this was in the early days of the Super Mono class and not everything was totally ironed out. At that time, it was not necessarily prototype. You had to have some bikes in production for, you know, homologation purposes and this and that. But now the class is just full on prototype, right? Like MotoGP is. So I don't know what Ducati is currently running in this championship, but it's something very similar to this. But this is the one you can actually buy.
I'm looking at a blown up picture of this. Is that a steering damper at like 90 degrees to the forks?
Yeah. Everything about this bike is bonkers. Absolutely everything. There, just the more you read about it, there's like a article you can find from like 1993 of a couple guys from which magazine was it? What does it say here? Cycle World. And it's like 3 pages of them talking about having one out at the track. And I don't think they mention the rider, but they've got some, you know, super awesome rider taking it around and around and around the track. And they're just making all these super crazy, like, you know, professional race team, like, you know, set up adjustments to it and everything. And they're getting their lap times down like more and more and more. And it's really gripping to read. And it's probably really, if I have to say, like from really the golden era of motorcycle magazine journalism. But what is crazy about this bike is this is just the pinnacle of race engineering from the time. And you can own this, right? This isn't the kind of thing where you're buying like a used Moto 2 or Moto 3 bike and you have to sign a contract that you'll never actually ride it. You know, you could buy.
This is like getting a. This is like buying a Ford GT that was like Le Mans, like a Le Mans class GT from Ford that's homologated.
Right. Now, you cannot get a street legal version of this thing, which is basically just because it doesn't have lights or turn signals, right? I guess you could just like put some LED lights on the sides of it or something and ride it around. But I don't know. It probably, there's probably no titles for these things or anything. But the thing is this is full on like essentially prototype race class craziness that you can purchase for maybe the cheapest of anything, right? I mean, what's it going to cost you to get a Moto 2 bike, right? Upwards of $100,000. Now, they did not make very many of these things at all, but I'm willing to bet that if you've got $50,000 or something and you're willing to be a little patient, you can obtain one of these. And it's a crazy, like, you will never be as good as this 550 single. You just won't be. And if you're just a normal human being and you haven't been doing, you know, crazy track stuff since you were 7 years old or whatever, this is just the most insane track bike thing you can get. And there are people that buy R1s and put more than $35,000 into them, right?
You know what? I think I actually like this more than the NR750.
Exactly, right? This is just so rare, so weird, but yet attainable, you know? And again, the way it looks, like if this bike is so cool. You know, I've talked about bikes that, you know, really sort of don't look complete unless there's an Italian supermodel smoking a cigarette sitting on the back. An Italian supermodel would make this look less cool. That's how fucking cool this motorcycle is. And this may be, I'm just going to say it. This is the coolest motorcycle of the 90s. Straight up. It's just so mean, but it's so beautiful in Ducati. It's so purpose built. You don't care that it's probably uncomfortable to sit on. You don't care about anything because all this thing is meant to do is just kick ass at track days at this point and not give a fuck. And it'd be so great to take to a track day too, because it's so weird, right? If you were a really talented rider, you'd probably be able to kick a lot of people's asses that have, you know, machines with a lot more horsepower, but it's so light. It's so nimble. It's so purpose built for the track that, you know, you've got to be running against guys that really have a lot of experience to really outdo you with something like this, right? You can take this to your racing club and just instantly be the coolest kid on the block.
Yeah.
Now, it's probably a nightmare to own. And after that $50,000, who knows what you're going to have to keep spending to keep it. But, you know, if you find one of these, because they didn't make very many of them, there's a good chance it won some legit races, right? Like when you do find one for sale, people will tell you, you know, which production number it is because there's so few of them, right? You're like, I own Ducati Supermono number 37. And people are like, oh, that's cool, right? It's so good. It's so good.
Okay, this is legitimately up there with the NR750, and it's a category that very few bikes actually reach.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that 99.5% of models don't reach the status. But this bike is too nice to ride.
Yeah. It's probably the kind of thing where, you know, you're a serious track guy. You buy one of these, you ride it around one day, and you don't really push it because you're afraid to fuck it up. And then you just put it back in a hyperbaric chamber. I also want to mention on the last episode, I had a lot of drinks and I said hyperbolic chamber. And listening back when I was editing, it just ate me alive, but I just did not have time to fix it or re-record something to put in there. I'm not an idiot. We were just hammered when we recorded the last episode. Anyway, yeah. So going back to how cool this is so cool that, I mean, I would trade a car worth twice its value for it. It's the type of thing that you kind of have to be just lucky enough to get the opportunity to purchase. But unlike something like a Ford GT, where you kind of just have to be lucky to get the opportunity to buy one, there's no club you have to be part of to buy one of these. And when they do come up, you can just sort of buy it. And that's fine. And, you know, that, cause that's the thing. This is NR750 levels of weird and cool and high technology or high tech track performance, but it's actually attainable. Now, yes, $50,000 is a shit ton of money. And realistically, most people aren't going to have $50,000 to just throw at this track day toy they're going to use a couple times. But it's not impossible, right? This is definitely only a tenth of as difficult to obtain someday in your life as, I don't know, name whatever other crazy car that you would just really love to have one day, right? You can do this. If you really want to commit to being double income, no kids for the rest of your life, right? Like, there's a way you can obtain one of these. And that makes it just so much more delicious to look at, to know that, you know, like, oh, I could do it one day. I could go there. And this is the kind of bike that you can buy for 50 grand. And this will be $200,000 before you know it.
Oh, yeah. This is an absolute, this is a total investment.
This is an investment bike, but it's functional. Like it's a pleasure to ride is the crazy thing about it. And again, I just want to go back.
Terrified to ride it.
Fuel injection in 93 on a motorcycle, 42 millimeter inverted forks, the crazy four piston Brembos. There's so much carbon fiber. Like carbon fiber really wasn't a thing, you know? This is so much carbon fiber on it, and just
this is back at a time where the only
stress how cool it looks.
This must have been really early on when gear driven cams, like linear, instead of with the 90-degree bevel drive,
right?
The linear gear driven cams became a thing, especially with the Desmo valves. I mean, this is at a point where it was mainly diesel trains that had gear-driven cams.
Right. And you know, I don't know how much like computer nonsense is in one of these. A lot of the electronic specifications I wasn't really able to get a hold of. This bike kind of exists in myth and legend until, you know, you go to like, you know, rarebikesforsale.com and then one pops up and someone writes a blurb about it and is like, holy crap, someone needs to buy this. This is Nicolas Cage's private collection, super cool. This is like Jay Leno, you know, is just like has a guy waiting for one of these to pop up, right? This, you know, because it's an investment, but also it's just so weird and beautiful. And it's not very often that world or those two worlds of weird and beautiful come together. And then this comes together with weird, beautiful, and it was competitive, right? Like the NR750 is weird and beautiful, but it didn't win shit. This won consistently. So, in terms of a track bike, this is the top of the mountain. Not because it's the fastest, but within its class, it just dominated. Nothing could come close. The technology's cool. The design is cool. It's a pleasure to ride. You know, you don't have to be superhuman to ride this thing around the track, right? You know, if you got your hands on a GP bike, even from 10 years ago,
I mean, this is about
without experience of riding crazy hardcore prototype things. It would be this like crazy thing for you to operate it for the first few laps, right?
Right. I mean, this
you could get on and go, but the thing is, it's so well designed, you could keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it and just get better. I mean, and better
this
and
is
better.
This is basically a Ninja 650 with like 14 more foot pounds of torque.
And like 150 pounds less.
Yeah.
Yeah. And way better, like crazy track suspension and everything. Like, I mean, this was $30,000 in 1993. So this would be like, what, $70,000, $80,000 today probably is what you'd end up. If they put out a version like this, I would expect it to come with a price tag like that.
Well, no, I think the original would be more expensive for the collector's value. If they came out with it today.
I believe you can buy these for like $50,000 now.
Really?
I think that's what I saw one listed for on rare sport bikes, but
that seems cheap.
I know. That's why I said it's obtainable. Like, it's really difficult to obtain, but it is obtainable. An NR750 is not obtainable. You need to be crazy famous and rich for that. This, you could, I don't know, I mean, you could just take out another mortgage on your home and get one of these. I both think that's a stupid idea and totally support that idea, you know?
You don't want to be that guy, but you want to be in the vicinity of that guy.
Yeah, you want to know that guy, right? This is bragging rights. This is like having, you know what? This is like having a Y2K for a lot less money. Right? It's that weird. It's that cool. It's that distinctive. And it's not like just another red Ducati, right? People will look at this and be like, wait, what the heck is that? Well, it looks so Ducati. Just even someone that barely knows anything about bikes would just take one look at this and go, wait a minute, what's going on here? That doesn't look quite like something I know.
So just looking at this bike in profile, you know, it does have that little bit of prototype look to it. But what I love about these kinds of bikes, that if you just turn that camera and just pointed it at the dash, it would just look like total garbage.
Yeah.
With some total bullshit, chintzy, aftermarket buttons and dash. That's actually the part of the bike I want to see more than anything else.
Yeah. And, you know, it's and I love the tail, too. The tail is like a crazy supermodel who's like way thin, and she's had like ass implants, and they've been like, they spent like, you know, I don't know, $2 million on like really expensive, perfectly shaped ass implants. It is just something else. Oh, I'm so in love with this. Like I said, I've had this 90s sport bike obsession for so long, but this one, this is the top of the mountain. There's nothing that comes close to being as cool as this is. Not even close.
I was actually prepared to fight you on this purely on the basis of that 2-star review, but I can't do it. You're totally right.
All right. Let's take a little break here and come back with another segment. Okay, we're back. I'm going to crack a beer on microphone for this one. So we're going to get a little bit serious now. And then we're going to move it a little bit more upbeat. This is going to be a little sad, but, you know, it's important to say. So what was the actual day that – well, okay. We're going to talk about William Dunlop. What was the day that he had the crash? It was last week, right?
Yeah, what day was it?
Well, it's weird because, you know, when we dropped this episode and when it happened, but it was a little while ago. It'll probably be like about 2 weeks from when you're hearing this.
July 7th.
There we go. So that was 10 days ago as of us recording this. You'll probably hear this in a few days. So, like, yeah, roughly 2 weeks ago, William Dunlop died in a crash. You may or may not have heard about this. If you're not clued into Irish road racing or just road racing around the UK and Europe in general, then you may not be familiar with William Dunlop. But he was an excellent racer, and he was part of a legendary racing family. And he died in a crash. I mean, all of these crashes where road racers die are usually especially bad crashes, because the whole dynamic of road racing is they're racing on public roads. They call it the furniture, the fence posts, the gates, the trees, the
stone walls.
The stone walls, all the stuff that's around. And these aren't real racetracks. They are public roads. There are potholes. There are manhole covers. I think in the TT, they replace all the manhole covers. They cover them up with something else and all of that for the Isle of Man.
Yeah, and they take the cat's eyes out of the road and everything like that.
Right. But
there are still curbs. There are still humps in the roads. There are still bridges.
There's no runoff of any kind anywhere. It's extremely dangerous. Now,
I think around a bunch of the roundabouts, they may put hay bales.
Yeah, that's about as good as it gets.
But, you know, if you're going down a road through a village at 180 miles an hour, and there's a cottage or a pub or a barn 3 feet off the road, if you come off the bike at an angle,
yeah,
you're going to hit it.
Yep.
That's the way it is.
And, you know, these guys do this, and it takes a certain breed of cat to do this. And I think William was a guy that probably was well aware of the risks involved in doing this.
Well, he was definitely well aware of the risks because he lost his father and his uncle to it.
It's true. We'll get into more of that in a minute. I just want to spend some time talking about him and his achievements. Now, he was 32. And he'd been racing for over a decade, I want to say. I think his first TT, Isle of Man TT, he did in, let me look this up here. It says 2006. So yeah, he was racing for 12 years. So since his early 20s, you know, professionally racing. Well, that was his first TT. I'm sure he actually did a lot of smaller road races before that.
Of the brothers were riding when their father died in 2000. Or was it 2000?
Joey died in 2000, their uncle. Anyway, this guy has had a whole bunch of Isle of Man podiums in all sorts of different classes, and that's no joke. That is serious. And he won all sorts of other races that are much lesser known than the Isle of Man TT. I mean, this was his job. He was a professional racer, and he was top level for that sport. And there's some reasons, you know, with the family history and the how legendary the Dunlop family is within road racing that makes this one kind of an especially hard loss. So we just kind of want to, you know, take a moment. You know, in fact, I think we should just do just a couple moments of silence here just because. All right. Now, William was, the older of two brothers racing. And Michael, definitely a more successful racer, but still the two of them together just have been just an incredibly dominant force in this British and Irish and European road racing scene for over a decade. Absolutely. Now, he died in the Skerries 100. Is that right?
Yes.
There we go. And it's in a, you can, there's on YouTube a video of the crash, and it's a crazy bad one. It is difficult to watch. I only just watched it because I hadn't at this point, I hadn't brought myself to do it, but wow, it's a crash. It's, he comes out of this turn. You can already see his back wheels out. He's lost all control, and just the distance, the speed, it's crazy. It's difficult to watch. And it gives you a sense of what these guys are putting on the line when they do this kind of racing, which is phenomenal racing to watch. It's just out of this world, crazy, awesome to go and see, but it carries something like this. And we kind of thought, because William died, we should kind of spend a moment just talking about him and the, well, not just a moment, a little bit here, talking about him and his brother and his father and his uncle, and really what they have done for motorcycle racing, because it's a huge contribution. Like, it cannot be understated. Now, if you want to go and just instantly stop this and go to Netflix and watch a movie called Road, that is an excellent movie about the whole family and their accomplishments, and it's so well done, and it's got some moments of just brutal honesty about how dangerous the sport is and how awesome the sport is and the roots of the sport and all kinds of crazy awesome things. And it's done really well, and I highly recommend it. And there's really no end of documentaries about his uncle Joey, which I think I've watched all of over the years, because Joey is a big hero of mine. So, William was the oldest son of Robert Dunlop, who was a great Isle of Man TT racer, or just, you know, TT racer, road racer in general as well. You know, if we think of people like, oh gosh, what's his name? Sideburns.
Guy Martin.
Guy Martin, right? That level of racer, right? You know who Guy Martin is probably from all the things he's done outside of road racing on TV and stuff. And he's a legendary road racer. Make no mistake. And Guy Martin probably has a few more wins than William did, but we're talking about that caliber of racer, that caliber of professional is what we're talking about with William here. So it's a thing that we lost him. Now, his brother Michael continues to race and is probably the third greatest road racer of all time at this point, I think, already at like age 29.
Possibly.
He's just fantastic. I think, what was it? Michael last year won 3 first place trophies in 3 different classes and picked up another podium. So he had 3 wins, 4 podiums, a 4th, and his worst result last year was a 5th place. Like, Michael is on track at some point to beat Joey, which will be one hell of a thing if that happens. And he's, I believe, on the heels of, what's his name? What? Road racer was teammates with Joey towards the end.
John McGinnis?
John McGinnis. Sorry. I just got so super serious, like, talking about William. I forgot John McGinnis's name, which is insane. John McGinnis, the only road racer to ever race GP, which is crazy. He did not do very well in GP, but he did 1 year in MotoGP in the 2-stroke days, I believe.
Well, it's important to, if you haven't really followed road racing, it's kind of, it's hard to really ground yourself and really understand what it is, because all the real money is in GP racing.
Yeah.
And it's all in formula racing on closed tracks with gravel pits, with gravel traps and air barriers and skid zones and all sorts of
airbags in your suits.
Airbags in your suits and all that, all the fancy safety features where if a rider crashes in a GP race, there's a 99% chance that they're totally fine.
Well, I don't, there's a 20 or 30% chance they've like messed up their wrist, broken a hand, broken a collarbone or something, but yet they're essentially okay.
Right. Whereas when you come off in a road race, in a TT race,
ooh, yeah, it's
50-50.
it's universally like you're going to the hospital. It's bad news.
And on top of that, as much of a spectacle as it is, it doesn't attract the top talent in general because it's a lot less money and it's a lot more dangerous.
Yeah.
And the result of that is that road racing is, more than anything, it's about having balls of steel and a very unhealthy disregard for your own health and safety.
Yeah, it's almost like a weird blood sport. It's this thing that's done out of tradition at this point. And, you know, the public supports it, and the public in the places where it's done has this amazing respect for it. It's sort of like a modern version of like Roman gladiator games.
Right.
That's the closest comparison I can come up with. Like, there's this immense respect that people get for doing it. Does the payoff equal that? I don't know. But when you become a legend in this, you're a legend forever. You are revered. Statues of you go up. I mean, literally, and we'll talk some more about that. It is a thing. And, you know, this area of the world, these counties, these small counties in Ireland and Northern Ireland where this is done, this is an area that just had its economy kicked in the nuts for hundreds of years on end. These are tough people. These are people that are willing to accept, for whatever reason, hardships that other people just can't even fathom, because that's the reality of their life, right? So the idea of these guys doing this and their families being behind it doesn't get much second thought. It's just kind of how life has been in that area of the world, and this sport emerges from it. And yeah, it's a little puzzling, but it is absolutely captivating. And it's tough. Like, people wonder how much longer these sorts of races are going to be around because they're so deadly. I mean, they're not as deadly as Formula One racing was in the 60s, but it's not far off. And yeah, was it like Ferrari lost like 8 drivers in 1 year in the 60s, and like Enzo Ferrari was like brought up on charges of like possible manslaughter or something, putting these guys in these cars? It's not to that level of danger, but it's pretty rough. But anyway, I want to talk about the Dunlops. So we're going to skim over Joey real quick because we're going to circle back to him at the end. But essentially in the 60s, you get this guy, Joey Dunlop, who with his friends is just racing on roads in Ireland. I mean, you got to think, this is like, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland, still a little rough these days, was really rough back then. I mean, this is making ends meet in the hardest of ways.
You also have to keep in mind that the Dunlops come from Ballymena.
Yeah.
Which is not only rough, but a total shithole.
It is. An even more peculiar Irish accent than the one you're used to, right? So this is British soil, Ballymena. A person in our lives from this area of the country. And the greatest thing ever said in that accent was talking about a local
fish and chip shop.
A fish and chip shop. He said, this is going to be bad, but I don't know. Hopefully a British listener can confirm that I'm like within 80% of how this sounds. He goes, "Have you seen the Parsons down? They're measly. All I got was a few chips and a bit of rice. They're measly portions done," right? You can barely understand what these people are saying. Joey was a little bit better, but it's only because he spoke so slowly and so deliberately and spoke very little at all. You could kind of tell what he was going on about.
I was surprised that Roe did not have subtitles.
Right. So anyway, you get him and a few friends riding around in the late 60s just doing these races and eventually figure out that, hey, enough people are doing it. People want to see it. And they start getting some races organized. And Joey and his brother Robert were really there from the beginning. And with a few other people and some people sort of helping them figure out how to set up these bikes and everything, they just became experts. And it's kind of a tradition to these days that the riders themselves are part of the pit crew, if not the head of the pit crew, right? They are the pit team managers as well as the racers. They're just all in. They live and breathe this to a level way deeper than the craziest GP riders.
And it's important to also remember that a lot of these riders aren't really professional riders. They'll have full-time jobs outside of being riders.
Yeah. But, you know, and they're quite often not even like trained certified mechanics. They've just spent enough time in garages with people just learning the tricks to set up these bikes. And that's what they do. So Joey and Robert start doing this. And by the mid-70s, Joey is emerging as a dominant force in doing this. And then he starts racing at the Isle of Man, which is the be-all and end-all of this kind of racing. I think it's 76. Yep. He starts going to the Isle of Man. And I think his second year, he got his first win. And then by the year 2000, long before that, was easily the most successful road racing and even on top of that, Isle of Man TT winning racer of all time. No one even close.
And it's important to really, you'll get this, you'll understand this if you go and watch Road, which I highly recommend. When you see all the videos of these guys from the time, from all the footage before the races and during the races, You'll get shots of these guys in full leathers with a cigarette hanging out of their mouths and more often than not rocking a hangover.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah. Just going for it.
Oh, yeah. These guys would get like crazy drunk the night before back in the 70s and 80s and stuff because they're like, hey, I might die tomorrow. And yeah. That was it. So, Joey gets his younger brother Robert into it, and Robert becomes quite the racer himself with, I think, 6 Isle of Man TT wins. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yep. And a whole bunch of podiums on top of that as well. And Robert went through some really rough crashes. At one point, his entire wrist was just completely frozen, disabled. He had to drop down to only the lightest weight bikes that he could race.
At the Isle of Man, the rear wheel on his bike on one of the practice laps.
Oh, yeah, it came off.
It just completely shattered.
Yeah.
It was the defective mag wheel, and all of the spokes just shattered in a chain reaction. He came off the bike, went into a stone wall, and when they finally got him fixed up, like, a whole bunch of nerves in his right arm had been severed, and they reattached them, and it all came back together, and in the end, after that race, he recovered, but he really didn't fully recover, and he didn't get full function in his right arm. And in the end, he ended up switching to 250 two-strokes and 125 two-strokes after that point, and he had a modified bike with the throttle flipped to the left handle.
Right. And there was a lot of things about, like, you know, the kind of weight and the kind of bike he could support since he really only had the other arm just to sort of hold onto the bike, but still was winning after that. He himself was an amazingly talented rider. So then we get around, 2000 and something, him getting his sons into racing. And like we said, William and Michael have both been extremely successful in road racing, and it's just been a whole family thing. And so since the beginning of Irish road racing, the Dunlop name has been a dominant force, a favorite to win every single year. So these guys are kind of a big deal. Now, are there writers that might technically be better? Well, it's a debate. Are there writers that can't do it, or are there other writers that won't do it? And that's the question. So no one really knows, right? And there's such a weird sort of stigma attached to these writers that I think, again, John McGinnis is the only one that I'm aware of that's really gotten a proper shot at GP racing. And he didn't do very well, and they dropped him after 1 year. And I'm not even sure if he did the full season. He may have just been like wild carding it for like 6 or 7 races or something like that. So moving on, I want to talk a little bit more about Joey. So in a previous episode, we had Evel Knievel as our first Hall of Fame, you know, entrant, right? So right now I'm putting Joey Dunlop in our Hall of Fame. For a multitude of reasons that we're going to dive in deeper now. So, Joey Dunlop, there's a statue of this guy on the Isle of Man. And I don't believe a statue of anyone else on the Isle of Man. There's a bar named after him. There are multiple foundations, charity organizations from this guy. All sorts of things. There's a memorial for him in Northern Ireland as well, in the town he was born. There, this guy is just a legend, and we're not going to be able to come close to telling you everything relevant about this guy, because he was a reserved person with a larger than life mystique about him at the same time. A really peculiar and captivating person. So like we said, he was really there at the beginning and just won all kinds of things all over the place. It would take us 20 minutes just to list all the podiums and wins amongst all the different races, all the different years. It's just insane. So all you need to know is that basically in this world of road racing, no one has won as much as him anywhere on anything, on any kind of bike. This guy raced at the years he was least involved, 2 different classes of bikes he was racing, and at times up to 5 different classes of bikes he'd be racing at the TT or whatever. No, I take that back, sometimes 6. So like 93, 94, he raced ultralight, lightweight, junior, super sport, Formula One, and the senior TT, right? And yeah, 94 as well. In 93, winning a first place and getting a podium. In 94, won 2 wins and 3 other podiums that year. So he's a big deal. He was always super duper like greasy and unkept, long hair, cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and a really quiet guy. He never wanted the attention. He just wanted to race the bike. And then that was it. I don't think he did a lot of autograph stuff or anything like that, but it just wasn't who he was. He just finished the race. He'd smile on the podium, and then he'd just go to the garage to work on his bike. And that was it. Every year.
Or to work on somebody else's bike.
Every year after the racing season was done, he would go by himself in a van. That he used to use to race in weird races all over all over Europe when he was on the Rothman Honda team. He would take this van and he would go out to like Poland and
Romania,
and he would just take clothing and food and supplies, and he'd go to different orphanages and just do charity work by himself, without his family, without any of his friends, just completely by himself. And for a long time, people didn't even really know what he was up to. I mean, they knew he was doing charity work and they knew vaguely where he was going, but they didn't know specifically which orphanages or anything he was going to. He would just leave on his own and he'd never say anything about it. It was just something he felt he had to do. Completely on his own, he'd go and do it, and And he was famous, you know? He was famous. It wasn't like he was Valentino Rossi famous, but if he was like at least Cal Crutchlow famous, right? Like if Cal Crutchlow went to some crazy place in the world to do charity work, you bet your ass there'd be a whole bunch of social media around it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Joey wanted nothing to do with anything like that. That's not who he was. And that's one of the reasons that he's this superstar character. Because on top of just winning, he was a person that everyone genuinely connected to, right? And he made this really human, soft, understanding, gentle face to this incredibly dangerous sport. Whereas everyone else is hard drinking and really bombastic. You know, like I said, like with the Roman comparison, these guys are sort of like gladiator warriors, right? They do this crazy thing and they get this social status from it and they really live the life to the max to gain everything they can out of doing it because it can all end on any given day when right. they're racing just like that. But Joey was different. Joey did it just for a personal need to do it. He made enough money. He could have quit doing it many times.
Well, that was one of the things. When right before he died,
mm-hmm.
His brother-in-law died on a motorcycle. And his way of dealing with it was to get in his van and drive off on his own to Estonia.
Yeah.
To attend
a small race.
Yeah. That didn't mean anything whatsoever, but he needed to be on the bike and get into that mindset. And that was his way of dealing with it.
Now, yeah, the last year of his life is a little bit crazy, and there's so many details, and like I said, we can't do justice to the whole story, but just to give you an idea, in 2000, the last time he went to the TT, he was 49 years old, and he won outright in three different classes, came third in the senior and fourth in the junior, the 600cc or the super sport, whatever you want to call it. The names change year to year on what these different classes are with slight rule changes. You really have to just like read a lot about the Isle of Man to figure out how everything works specifically. It's one of the things that frustrates me about it. But anyway, so he won three different trophies, first place and another podium at age 49. Like he at the top of his game. So if you think Valentino Rossi is impressive at 39, just still being relevant in GP, at age 49, this guy was still at the top of his game, right? So John McGuinness, I don't think, is even 49 now. He might be 46, 47, something like that. I might be a little off, but John McGuinness is basically thrown in the towel, coming, I think, within 10. Maybe even within five of all the wins that Joey got. So John McGuinness is kind of the second most successful TT rider of all time right now, which is a big deal as well. And he's kind of called it quits before he even hit Joey's numbers. And maybe no one ever will hit Joey's numbers. It's that crazy. And yeah, so after that, his buddy died on a bike, and then he went to Estonia, did a small race, and just had a weird crash and died, because that's the sport. At any given moment, it can just take you. It's absolutely nuts. So, you know, in talking about like William and dying and everything recently, it's sad, but it's something these guys sign up for. They're aware of the risk. No one's forcing them to do it. And that's important to keep in mind with all of this, because it's easy to be completely turned off by this kind of racing. It's always impressive to think about what they're accomplishing on these bikes on the road. But a lot of people find it really curious that, you know, it's a guarantee that someone's going to die at the Isle of Man every year. It's just a guarantee. Yeah. And that's kind of crazy and sad and tragic, but it's what makes the event in a lot of ways. I mean, no, what makes it the event is the incredible talent, the speed, the, you know, what it takes to do this race is what makes it that. But the fact that there's that death thrown in there really adds a different level to it. Now, this used to be something that was common in motorsports all the time and has largely died out, except in this little corner of racing here.
Yeah. If you look at Formula One and all of the runoffs and all the improvements in safety and the gear that the drivers wear and the safety improvements in the cars themselves, and you look at MotoGP with the airbags and the gravel traps, and you look at all the different ways that motorsports have changed, it's much rarer than it used to be.
It's true. But what makes Joey significant is he came from the late 60s, early 70s, when there was really just no safety gear. I mean, they had full body leathers and that was it. The helmet still might have been out of the 1940s. You know what I'm saying? There was really nothing in terms of safety or whatever. And the death toll was crazy high. And that was just what was expected. And then he raced all the way to 2000. I mean, the bike he won on in 2000 was an RC51. So he really was this bridge from the old world of racing to just when the new era of racing was starting, right? He went all the way from 1976 to fuel-injected motorcycles, right? He bridges that gap. He's a connection between the classic black and white photos of racing. You know, he was there doing that thing, and at the turn of the century, still relevant and, in fact, on the top of his game, right? I don't know of anyone else in racing that does that, right? There's no one from NASCAR, right? There's the Petty racing family, but Richard Petty didn't race from 1977 to 2000, right? It would be like, yeah, it would be like if Richard Petty raced until the year 2000.
It's kind of like the equivalent of Sir Christopher Lee going from garroting krauts in the trenches to marrying Dutch royalty to playing
Count Dooku
and what's his name from Lord of the Rings?
Oh, Sauron? Not Sauron.
Not Sauron.
I know what you're talking about, though. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, not a bad comparison either. It's not totally on point, but that's pretty close, too. Yeah.
This is like a total crossing of worlds from...
Yeah. Joey Dunlop was this strange time machine in racing, as well as being completely relevant. I mean, the last year of his life was the most successful year of him racing ever. And if you watch the videos of him taking those trophies at the Isle of Man in 2000, I mean, just the extreme, not just the extreme joy he had, like, in taking those trophies, but in everyone around him. There was no win within the world of motorcycle racing that everybody wanted so much, you know? Everybody wanted it. Like, you could even tell, like, you know, like John McGuinness, like, said, you know, he was so happy to lose to him. I mean, during the race, he was like, I'm going to catch him, and that's all there is to it. But he was almost happier that he took second place and Joey got those wins, because nobody thought he could do it. Everyone thought he was washed up and he'd lost it, because he'd won every year since 92. And then in 99, he didn't win anything. He got one podium and everyone thought, all right, he's finally fallen off. You know, he's old. All his hair was gray at this point. And he'd kind of gotten out of shape for a couple of years. And in 2000, he'd done a lot of training and he'd really done a lot of work to make a return to it, because that's just who he was. And, you know, there might have been people that were more talented motorcycle riders and more talented motorcycle racers, or just racers in general in any discipline of racing at the time. But what makes Joey so significant is that Joey was purely racing. And not in the sense of being bombastic or a larger-than-life personality or an attention-getter or a huge celebrity. He was extremely good at it. One of the all-time best within his specific discipline of racing. But unlike anyone else, it just is who he was. He is the absolute archetype of what you would hope to be. And I think even though he had this weird, like, unkept look to himself, I think Joey Dunlop was the last gentleman racer. Even though he didn't come from a wealthy family or any nobility, he wasn't sponsored by a big team. Well, he had some big, like, Honda sponsorships within that world. He was a big deal within that smaller world. But in being a gracious winner, a gracious loser, a mentor to other riders, and just the embodiment of the sport, I don't know that we've had someone like Joey Dunlop since. And for that reason, he's in the Hall of Fame for me. And there we go. All right. So that sums up for us right now, Joey Dunlop and William, Michael, Robert, and the amazing Dunlop family. Let's take a little moment here to do a little cleaning up at the end of this episode. All right. So once again, I want to remind everybody, please leave us some reviews. And, you know, if you're going to leave a shitty review, as described earlier in the episode, I'm totally all about that. But have the decency to, like, really shit talk and make it a one star. No, you don't have to do that. But, you know, please do that for us. That'd be fantastic. We're getting all these, like, new listens in, and the amount of ratings that we have totally doesn't match up with the amount of listens that we have. So if we can just show that we've got some engagement, that'd be super awesome, guys. All right, so we're going to do the outro a little bit different this time. I'm going to remind you to send us an email at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. I'm going to remind everyone to stay safe and stay tuned, and we're going to cut out with a different piece of music that we think perfectly sums up Joey, Robert, Michael, and William, the Dunlop Racing family, and their entire outlook on the world as best as we can. You want to roll it, Swigs?
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line, engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up, churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank, fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns, their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down, the fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man still driving and striving as fast.
All right, now in order to use this legally, we are obliged to put in some sort of commentary over it, but having said that, now let's just fade out.